Want a chance to win 250 pounds in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be 250 pounds better off.
Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. Donald Trump's first presidential term meant that many allies, including in Europe, were forced to consider the possibility that the United States could no longer be a reliable partner in global affairs. With Trump's return to the White House last year and the resurgence of his America First agenda, Europe has had to return to that way of thinking as it reconsiders its own economic and military security. And Europe has not been unified in its response to Trump, with divisions over the ongoing war in Ukraine and the US conflict with Iran. Trump's tariff policies have also further complicated the EU's relationship with the US and with its other global trading partners. To discuss the EU's turbulent relationship with the US, in March 2026, I spoke to Kathleen McNamara, professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University and a visiting professor at the Phelan US Center. Her work focuses on markets, culture, and politics in the European Union and the United States, with particular interest in industrial policy, money, and globalization. I began our conversation by asking Professor McNamara to outline their research and current work.
I'm Kathleen McNamara. I'm at Georgetown University, where I'm a professor of government and foreign service. So I'm in the School of Foreign Service in the Department of Government there. My work has tended to look at a couple different sort of buckets of things. One thing I'm really interested in is the global political economy, how it works, and really trying to think through how do markets work, and particularly what's the role of power in structuring markets, and what's the role, on the other hand, of culture and social identities. I think a lot of times people tend to reduce markets down to sort of supply, demand, sort of narrow economic things. In my career, I've really spent trying to think through how politics and culture matter for markets. The other kind of big group stuff that I've been doing is thinking about the European Union, because the EU is a really interesting sort of anomaly in today's world. We have sovereign states, we have international organizations, but the EU represents this really innovative and interesting governance form. It's a polity that's kind of emerging over time, changing, very dynamic. And so I've had a lot of fun over the past three decades sort of tracing its changes and trajectory, no more so than today, which I think we'll get into.
Thanks so much for that. So my first question really is about the EU and who's in the White House right now, President Trump. What impact has Trump's return to the White House had on US-EU relations? And what have been the consequences of his policies for EU unity?
Well, Trump has had an enormous impact. You can actually look back already to 2016 in his first administration, where he really set about, in fact, trying to kind of disrupt and dismantle the European Union. His National Security Council was staffed with folks who actually were given explicit mandate to try to think about ways they could sort of create cleavages in Europe. He found the EU, I think, something far outside his way of understanding what politics is, right? Sovereign states coming together and cooperating in such a deep way. And so the EU at that point started to rethink some of its alliances with America and rethink its reliance on the United States, both for its economic future as well as its security future. But of course, we had President Biden come in and things sort of settled down to some degree. But of course, Trump's second term has been enormously disruptive, really almost from day one. It's very interesting to think about sort of key focal points for a readjustment on the European side of thinking through its relationship with the United States. And I would say the famous Munich Security Council conference meeting in 2025, when J.D. Vance gave what many found a very shocking speech, sort of calling Europe to task for somehow not really being a supporter of democracy and civil liberties and free speech at a moment when Europe was really looking for American leadership around Russia's continued war on Ukraine. And then the second focal point happened later on in that month, February 2025, when Zelensky comes to the Oval Office. And again, there's this sort of huge kind of eruption with Trump in the Oval, where many of the kind of certainties that people had about America's role in the world in trying to make sure that Europe would be peaceful and secure was completely sort of thrown into question. So Europe has really had to, following those kind of key moments, think very hard about how to build its own security capacities, how to think about how to protect itself from economic coercion in terms of trade and investment with the United States. So it's been a real awakening in time of great disruption in terms of that relationship.
You talked about Trump essentially having a hard time getting his hands around the EU and what it was. Can you talk a bit more about that? Is it because the EU is a federal system unlike the US? Is it because it's made up of countries that have individual leaders, but it has a commission president? What are Trump's difficulties with the European Union?
That's a great question, and I'm sure I won't do complete justice to it because I think it's certainly a multifaceted answer. But I would actually start with the notion that the EU really was a very explicit peace project. After two devastating wars on the continent, with the European coal and steel community sort of harnessing these key materials of war fighting, coal and steel, and pooling them together under German and French control, really is a sort of fascinating case of countries voluntarily giving up their military capacities and their sovereignty over their foreign policy to some degree. And so I think Trump is somebody with his America First agenda, with his very sort of personalistic way of governing, who simply can't fathom that degree of deep collaboration, and moreover, perhaps sees it as a threat to his particular vision of what politics should be and his story about why the America's First agenda is the way forward in today's world.
You've talked about this a little bit already, but how has Trump's policy towards the EU in his second term differed from that of his first? And how is it different from the EU-related policies of his predecessors?
So I would start perhaps on the sort of economic side. The EU has traditionally in the post-war era been America's most important trade and investment partner. We tend to think about China's rise in the global economy, but actually the sort of engine of globalization to some degree has been this deep and long-lasting and sort of ongoing set of economic and market relationships between Europe, particularly the EU, as well as the UK and the US. And Trump comes in and throws all of that, not just in the case of the EU, but in terms of the global economy, into question. In his first term, he sort of threatens some tariffs. He puts up some tariffs against China. But in his second term, with his so-called Liberation Day, when he sort of went, I guess, through an AI-generated or ChatGPT-generated list of countries, putting up these incredibly large tariffs against countries all over the world, including the EU, that was sort of unprecedented and unheard of. We had had decades upon decades, really, of a constant sort of lowering of barriers to trade and investment. And in a fell swoop, Trump comes in and says, that's all over. So that's, I think, the first important change and truly shocking, again, not only to Europe, but to countries around the world, Canada, the global South, etc. I think the second thing that's so important is, again, going much, much further and in a much more visible and striking way in a second term, to really question the foundations of NATO, which again, we're talking about decades and decades, right? Where politics and the geopolitical order had been organized around this idea of American leadership, but a sort of benevolent hegemony, that America would be this powerful actor that would provide security, certainly for Europe and for Asia and lots of other parts of the world. Trump again comes in and really throws a lot of questions around the willingness of the United States to stand behind its NATO commitments, no more so, of course, than in his seeming threats against Greenland, where there seemed to be some sort of direct attack on the notion of territorial sovereignty. Obviously, Denmark being a NATO country. This was, again, quite shocking to people. So very big break with the first term.
So Trump's second term has been really characterized by what are known as his America First policies. What differences exist within the EU in their response to the US? And how has this impacted the bloc's unity when dealing with Trump?
So when we think about the impacts of the America First across the EU, it is important to kind of try to parse out what are the different situations of the various EU countries that would lend them to sort of be more affected or less affected. And I immediately think of the kind of division between states that are moving more towards autocracy or in autocracy like Hungary with Orbán, who presumably are all for the America First agenda, for whom, for example, J.D. Vance's comments at Munich may not have been threatening, but rather reassuring, because countries like Hungary are in fact completely on board with this sort of transnational far-right agenda, which have to do with curtailing civil liberties, human rights, which have to do with concentrating power in the executive, make the world safer autocracy again. And so presumably countries that are more historically committed to a sort of liberal democratic vision, such as the core countries of Europe, would seem to be those that would be much more opposed to and impacted by America First. I think the other interesting division is what we're seeing right now on the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, that the Spanish leader Sanchez has come out so very strong and articulated very clearly his opposition to that war, his opposition to arguably a sort of American imperialist warmongering violence and coercion. That really is an interesting sort of example of, I think, some European countries that really want to draw a line between Europe and America in its current form. But on the other hand, we've had other countries that have been more willing, and, you know, for example, outside the EU, the UK, have been more willing to provide their bases as landing platforms and so on, have been willing to provide much more support to the EU. So I think that's another really interesting cleavage. Economically, I think the EU, we see actually more convergence across the EU. It's hard for me to kind of think about any state that's necessarily winning economically from Trump's policies. We have been watching sort of carefully Giorgia Meloni, the leader of Italy, because she comes from more of a right-wing populist background. And she has tended to be, in a personal sense, much more friendly with Trump. They get along very well. But I think it's hard to make an argument that somehow she is an example of a Trump supporter who has fully thrown all of her political capital behind him. I think she still views the EU as the most important sort of safe harbor for Italy. And therefore, I think I wouldn't put her completely in the Trump column.
So in recent years, scholars, including yourself, have highlighted the more assertive tone the EU has taken on issues such as the US designs on Greenland and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Has this shift in tone benefited the EU's authority and policy responses to those powers? And I guess another aspect of this is, has it made the EU more unified?
So I think the EU is in this moment of turbulence. I would be wrong to give you a yes or no binary answer to that question. I think many of the EU experts right now would disagree. I think if you polled across people who follow the EU very closely or people who are involved in EU politics, I have, as a scholar, sort of made it my business to take a very long view when it comes to the EU, to the point that a lot of my work thinks about the EU as a what I call a comparative political development project. What do I mean by that? That the EU is, as I mentioned at the top, something that's very innovative and really doesn't have a clear parallel today. But it is not innovative in the sense that over centuries and centuries, we've actually seen new political forums come to life, sort of hang around for a while, and then fall to the side. Except for the sovereign state. Today's sovereign state is basically invented in the late 19th century. So it's a pretty new political form, but it was sort of the winner. So we had these other political forms over time. Think about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, which comes around at the same time. Colonialism, empire, but the sovereign state sort of wins out. By the, I would say, World War II, the end of World War II. And I think that we should put EU in this kind of long line of new emergent political forms. So in some of my work, I look back at things like the Hanseatic League or the Italian city-states to kind of try to suss out what are similar things and what are different things in terms of how the EU is being formed and the political logics that underpin it. And so when I think about sort of where the EU is going and its question of whether we're going to see more unified Europe as a security actor, I do see historically that in times of sort of universally recognized threat, political actors tend to have a lot of room for maneuver, a lot of room for sort of concentrating power, building administrative capacity, doing things like taxing, all kinds of sort of fiscal capacity sorts of things. And arguably, the sort of double whammy of Putin's invasion of Ukraine and Trump's second term have set up the conditions that make it more likely that the EU will continue moving towards a sort of standalone security capacity and a more unified foreign policy. lots of caveats with that, and we can kind of get into those, but let me kind of leave it there for a moment.
Well, that flows really well into my next question, which is, in an article last year in 2025, you argued that the EU needs to develop a standalone integrated military capacity to become a truly global power. Could you talk about what this looks like in practice and how the EU's economic power might also be harnessed to achieve that goal?
So I've been trying to kind of, again, leverage sort of what we know from history, lessons from history, to try to sort of speculate about what might be driving the EU or what might be politically important as we continue on this path of a much more geopolitical world. And so I would, I guess, point to, first of all, the EU is not a state. It's not a sovereign state, and it will likely never be a sovereign state. So even though I'm arguing we can draw comparisons to the sort of history of state formation or state building, as it's called, we also have to be careful about that. So I would argue, first of all, that we're not likely to see something that's like a unified European army, for example. And certainly it won't be called a European army. Instead, it will be this sort of close, networked, sort of tethered together, transnational set of military capacities across the member states, but which do have a very strong kind of European level framework governing them, in which you see decision making very much shared, almost like the closest alliance you could ever imagine, with a real kind of institutional and sort of backing and real kind of political authority that moves to the center. So have in your mind more this notion of a kind of network of armies and air forces and surveillance capacities and intelligence capacities and so on. And it's probably going to have the UK in that network. This isn't going to be just an EU project, because the UK is, of course, going through all these growing pains that the EU is going through in terms of questions of the reliability of its alliance with America. So people often use the phrase a multi-speed Europe. So it's going to be networked. We may well see groups of states, France, Germany, Italy, and so on, and the UK going forward with a much tighter sort of alliance integration, and other states choosing to stay more in the periphery. And as I mentioned, Spain has tended to, in popular opinion and its elite level views, to be more skeptical of this sort of notion of the militarization of the EU. So that's, I think, the important starting point. I could, again, go on about lots of other things. I think keeping your eye on the funding of all this, moving funding to the European level, having some sort of European bank for military spending, potentially sort of really doubling down on the notion of some sort of debt instrument at the European level, which they've already done with COVID, with the military spending, but having an ongoing kind of, and again, probably won't use this word, Eurobond, but some sort of European debt instrument. The EU always has to navigate these sort of national sensitivities around this stuff. That's why the European army, which of course Nigel Farage has made a big show throughout his career of talking about, to stir people up. But there are lots of things the EU does, not using the terminology of sort of sovereign states. Like, there is an EU foreign secretary, but it's not called a foreign secretary. It's a high representative for, I have to literally look at it every time I teach, high representative for security and defense, whatever. And so I think we're going to continue to see lots of forward movement, but it won't exactly replicate what we're used to with sovereign states.
And on the point about Europe doing more on sort of defense and military integration, do you foresee the US ever being able to step back from the defense of Europe? Does it want to step back from the defense of Europe? Trump's made a lot of noise about European states increasing their defense spending as per NATO commitments. Does the US want to leave Europe alone to do its own thing in the face of countries like Russia?
I think the answer is a clear yes. And I think Europeans that don't see that are fooling themselves and really need to open their eyes. And maybe it's because I sit in Washington, but I would be very wary of imagining somehow that Trump can be trusted. And moreover, that even should Trump leave office, that somehow the NATO relationship and the deep transatlantic ties can be reconstituted. Once you break that sort of institution, you really can't put it back together again. Those levels of trust, the levels of institutional ties, the practices, the norms, and let's not forget the people, right, who make those things work. On the American side, Trump has really gutted the administrative state. People at the State Department, people in the Defense Department, the National Security Council, which is the sort of big policy driver for a lot of things, have been completely hollowed out. And it's very hard for me to imagine Humpty Dumpty being able to put back together again. So I think we really are at a moment of reckoning.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win £250 in vouchers.
Shifting to economic matters now, following the US Supreme Court's tariff ruling, what's the status of the potential EU-US trade deal?
You tell me. I think one of the biggest challenges, right, with those of us who are trying to sort of understand, analyze, and presumably react to Trump is that it's very hard to know how his administration is reacting to the Supreme Court ruling. One thing that I've noticed is that, you know, whereas in the past, trade treaties would be the product of sort of years and years of intense sort of expert study and negotiation between all the actors, the way the Trump administration has made trade policy is very much sort of shooting from the hip out of the White House. The Liberation Day, quote unquote, tariffs, for example, from what I gather, the executive agency that's responsible for making trade policy, the U.S. Trade Representative, which sits right next to the White House, was not told until 8 a.m. the morning that it happened. My father actually was a trade negotiator, and I grew up in Geneva, Switzerland when he was doing a trade round there. And I'm sure he's rolling in his grave because that's not how you make trade policy. And so trying to think about, on the part of the EU, again, reacting to American trade policy when it's being made in this extremely ad hoc, personalistic way is very hard. And I would argue that the EU needs to sort of figure out its own path forward. One thing that's been interesting to watch, of course, is the sort of potential rise of what we would call middle powers. So Canada, Mark Carney coming to the fore of conversations about trying to figure out how to lock in and ensure we still have the benefits of globalization, of free trade and investment across borders, while managing it in ways so that states can be short of sustainability in their environmental goals or security in terms of things like AI and chips, but imagining a world that designs around America and figures out ways to develop trade treaties that can ensure trade flows continue with those states. So I would say that's the way forward, not trying to calculate and second guess negotiations with Trump.
So how has the EU's response to Trump's tariffs shaped its own trade and financial strength with other regions of the world, such as Asia, particularly China, or maybe even the Middle East?
That's really interesting and sort of follows on from my points about, you know, can we imagine a world that designs around the U.S. as a much more isolationist, autarkic place? And of course, the U.S. is a big market, and so it can presumably sort of wall itself off a little bit from the global economy. But the middle powers, the smaller states, you know, are very much dependent on global trade flows. And I really feel for EU trade officials who are trying to navigate this moment, because they all sort of grew up in a time when free trade was thought as something that would benefit everyone. Theory of comparative advantage is, guess what? Everyone wins, no matter what you make, no matter how far behind you are sort of in innovation or industrialization. And so I think they're really struggling to figure out exactly this sort of question of how do we go forward? So I think the fact that the Mercosur trade agreement was concluded finally after many, many years, and this is the trade agreement between the EU and Latin America, is a sort of example and a blueprint for a path forward of trying to negotiate trade agreements with countries in Asia, Latin America, Africa, and really reimagining what could the global economy look like, and not sort of saying, well, if America can't be the benevolent hegemon, it's now the malevolent hegemon, let's all give up and take our toys and go home. And instead sort of, well, maybe we can think about ways of projecting leadership out in a collaborative way. So, I mean, I hope that's what the EU does. On China, again, the EU is in a really difficult spot because China, of course, is not a free market capitalist system. It's very good at its industrial policy and subsidizing all kinds of goods that the EU wants to actually promote and be competitive in, and is very important for European goals of things like climate change and sustainability. And so I think the EU is really in this balancing act of trying to maintain its economic openness with China, but in a smart way that protects these critical industries.
So one of the most obvious manifestations of divides between the EU and US has been over the response to the war in Gaza, and to some extent, more recently, the US-Israeli war in Iran, with some member states being more critical of Washington and Israel than others. What explains these divisions in the bloc's stance, and have there been any internal consequences because of these differences?
So I would say, I mean, this is a very difficult and sensitive topic, the question of Gaza and the catastrophic humanitarian genocide, I will use that word, that is occurring there. I think for a very long time, because of the tight alliance with the United States, many in Europe were hesitant to speak up, because the U.S. has historically had such a tight and close relationship and alliance with Israel. And so I actually think this is a moment potentially of opening, where if the U.S. is no longer the only and key security provider for Europe, that we could start to see much more light between European stances on the relationship with Israel and what is happening in Gaza. I will say, as a professor, I'm struck by the kind of differences in how students talk about this in the classroom in Washington versus in Europe. And when I've had European students in my classes at Georgetown, there's a willingness to be sort of much more open and much more critical of Israel and the horrors that we're seeing in Gaza. But in the United States, there really has been a deep reluctance to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So I am actually hopeful, perhaps, we'll start to see Europe being able to play a more positive role.
How might European policymakers adapt their strategies to better deal with the U.S.? And how might they leverage the strengths of operating as a regional bloc rather than individual nations?
So one of the challenges of dealing with President Trump is that we have, it seems, moved from the world that we're all comfortable with and familiar with of sort of thinking about policymaking in terms of, if you like, Max Weber's rational bureaucratic ways of thinking about policymaking. There's a policy problem, you bring together all your experts, you work on it for a long time, you get the bureaucracy into it, you figure out the best way forward, you might have to negotiate and deal with all the different actors. But that's really how I think all of us who are living in this moment thought about policymaking. I think with Trump, we're now moving from that rational bureaucratic way of thinking about things to a much more personalistic or sort of patrimonial, I think is what Max Weber called it, where power is concentrated in one person. And it's about sort of the favors that you get from that one person and doing deals with that one person based on that person's particular desires. When Trump first came into office the second time, I was really struck by the lessons we might learn from a sort of early modern Chinese tributary system, where the emperor ruled, again, not with this sort of rational bureaucratic stuff, but through gifts and kowtowing. That's how you curried favor with the emperor, is you paid him gifts, you paid him off, and you kowtowed, you prostrated yourself. You showed that they were, in fact, the imperial leader. And so the EU, I think we've seen a variety of ways of trying to deal with him. If you look at the head of NATO, Mark Rutte, the former prime minister of the Netherlands, he seems to be trying to curry favor in a lot of different ways and sort of act and say things to Trump to make Trump think that he's somehow impressing Mark Rutte. Other people, like I was mentioning, Pedro Sanchez, have come out in a much more clear way to talk about the ideals and the visions and the sort of values that are being run over with a truck with Trump. I'm not exactly sure where I would put Ursula von der Leyen on all this. I think she began trying to curry favor, and I think she's gradually sort of realizing that may not get the EU anywhere, and has started to become more hardline and more of the view that she needs to actually not worry so much about making deals with Trump and just go forward in terms of bringing the EU together as a bloc.
And as we look to the uncertain future of the geopolitical order, what major challenges do you foresee for EU-US relations and the development or the maintenance of the EU's own political authority?
Oh, I think that one of the biggest challenges will be, again, this kind of pervasive effort on the part of Trump and hangers-on for Trump, Trump cronies, to continue expanding the role of the far right in Europe. Steve Bannon, who was around in the first Trump administration, has apparently been a very important political consultant to groups like the AfD and so on. And so I think that the problem of the U.S. trying to influence from within, which of course people have also pointed to is a problem coming from Russia as well, misinformation and so on, will be a sort of issue. That's probably the most important thing. But we shouldn't also discount the fact that the reason why the right-wing populist movements have been able to become popular is not only because of external influence, but because of shortcomings in terms of national governance and EU governance. That the EU and the national governments need to really make sure that they make people feel that they are being taken care of, feel that inequality and the kind of concentration of wealth and so on is something that is being dealt with. And so I think that the EU also has to make sure that it pays close attention to sort of democratic transparency, accountability, and really trying to address people where they are, as opposed to sort of assuming that there'll be support no matter what.
So in a recent article, you wrote that the EU faces a unique opportunity to lead a new rules-based international order in an era of American retreat and heightened global uncertainty. So a lot of commentators are talking about the retreat of the US from the global order. Can the EU lead a global order in the era of post-American hegemony?
I think it really will depend on making the kinds of arrangements and relationships with other interested, motivated states. Talked a lot about, I think, Canada as being really important. I think the UK is very important. States in Asia, particularly Japan, Korea, incredibly important. And then states in the global south. So I guess what I'm trying to kind of imagine, again, is this notion of, could there be a world that is decentered from the US that doesn't rely on American hegemony? Now, political science literature, particularly in international relations, would argue no. Then, in fact, there are huge kind of public goods problems, what they call collective action problems, where most people just want a free ride. They want to kind of cheat the system. And so I guess I would say I challenge European leaders to kind of not accept that as an answer and really step in and try to provide leadership.
And that's a great place for us to finish. But before we do finish, I'd just like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, I think if people are interested in following up on this question of how a changed geopolitical landscape might be reshaping the EU and the kind of political logics, I really unpack that and use historical examples in a very recent piece from last month, January 2026, in something called the Journal of European Integration. You just Google McNamara Journal of European Integration. It's called A Market for War? And it really traces through sort of how a new military industrial complex in the EU to support this militarization may play through and flag some of my concerns around, is the EU prepared in terms of its sort of democratic representation? I mean, war and threat, again, is a very kind of politically sensitive thing that creates huge opportunities for mischief, to be honest. And so I think it's really important that we think through the democratic questions involved. And so I would point people there. I also am on Blue Sky, Prof. K. McNamara, I think is my label handle. And I also do often post like threads of my recent work and recent thoughts, so people can check that out.
Thank you, Anne. We'll link to those in our show notes, along with all the other resources and articles we've talked about today as well. Just remains me to say, Professor Kathleen McNamara, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Kathleen McNamara is Professor of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a visiting professor at the Phelan U.S. Center. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Kathleen McNamara for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at lse_US. On LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Kilson and Avan Fattah. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast don't reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!